So picture this massive vintage illustration. Right in the center, hovering up in this dark sky, is this giant, just menacing puppet master's hand.
Oh, yeah, it's quite the image.
Right, and hanging from its fingertips are these thick strings, and those strings are tied directly to a classic folded newspaper, an old school television set with a big dollar sign on the screen and a glowing social media icon. And then down below all of that, there's just a massive faceless crowd of people staring up, completely tethered to these objects.
Dangling there, basically.
Exactly. And you know, that image isn't from a sci-fi movie or some dystopian graphic novel. It is actually the central guiding metaphor right on the cover of a massive 2026 analytical report from the American newspaper and American TV, and it's all about media hegemony.
It is a profoundly striking image, I have to say. And I think it works so well because it instantly taps into this very human suspicion we all have,
Check
right?
it, conspiracy.
Exactly. The idea of a grand secret conspiracy. A single shadowy figure in a smoke-filled room pulling the levers of society and just deciding what we all think.
Which is exactly what makes the very first page of this report so surprising, because the authors point directly to that AI-generated cover illustration, and they basically say, well, forget the puppet
Look,
master.
shut it down right off the bat.
Yeah, they say that is entirely the wrong way to look at this. There is no secret cabal dictating the headlines. So our mission for this deep dive is to explore this exact report for you, the listener, to really help you understand the real invisible architecture of how society decides what is real, what is credible, and what is just considered normal.
And the report establishes a core thesis right out of the gate here. Media hegemony is never about a single actor secretly controlling a newsroom. It's about durable structural patterns of power. So it's an examination of, well, what gets selected to be news, what gets quietly omitted, whose voices are recognized as authoritative, and which assumptions become so incredibly familiar that they appear to be ordinary common sense rather than actual debatable political choices.
The deepest form of media power isn't spiking a controversial story. It is shaping the entire playing field where society decides what is even, legitimate to talk about.
Exactly.
But, I mean, if there is no singular puppet master intentionally brainwashing the public, we are left with a massive puzzle. We have to figure out how this invisible system of control actually works on our minds to create that tethered crowd from the illustration.
Right, the mechanics of it.
And to get there, the report traces the Greek roots of the word hegemony, which just means leadership or command. But it quickly pivots to an Italian political theorist from the early 20th century, Antonio Gramsci.
Oh, Gramsci is the absolute foundation here. I mean, he completely transformed the concept of hegemony into a mechanical theory of how political and cultural rule is actually sustained in modern democracies. His central insight was that a ruling order in an advanced society, it just cannot possibly be maintained purely by coercion.
Wait, okay, I'm getting a bit tripped up here. Let's look at coercion for a second. Like, if I'm paying my taxes and obeying the speed limit, I am doing that because of the threat of coercion, right?
Straight jail or fines, state force.
I'm not doing it because the local newspaper convinced me to. So how exactly does a journalist's worldview or like their word choice equal a ruling order?
It's a really great question. Look, coercion, compelling behavior through force or the threat of it, that is always the ultimate backstop. The state always has the police and the prisons. But Gramsci realized that using force is incredibly expensive. It's unstable and it's exhausting for a government. For long-term durable stability, you really don't want to use force. You want to win consent.
So you need the public to actively agree with the structure of society?
Yes, and that consent is manufactured within civil society, through schools, churches, and crucially, the mass media.
So they aren't forcing you to obey. They are organizing how you interpret reality so that obedience just feels like your own idea.
That is the mechanism, exactly. Gramsci argued that a dominant order achieves true hegemony when its specific worldview is experienced by the public, not as some partisan doctrine, but just as the natural, practical way the world works.
I've heard hegemony compared to the invisible water that fish swim in, but honestly, that always felt a bit vague to me.
It is a bit abstract, yeah.
While reading this report, a totally different analogy came to mind. Hegemony operates a lot like the default setting on your brand new smartphone.
Oh, I like
All
that.
right. You take it out of the box, and certain apps are just already on the home screen. The privacy settings are already configured in a specific way. The notification sounds are pre-selected.
Right, it's all set up for you.
And now you can go into the menus and completely change all of it. You have the absolute freedom to do that. But most people never do. The defaults just become your normal experience of the phone. So Hegemony is the media setting, the societal defaults.
That captures it beautifully. And a massive part of how the media installs those default settings, so to speak, is through everyday language. Yeah, language normalizes categories before a political debate even has a chance to start. Just think about the labels we hear constantly on the news. Let's take the word reform. What does that word naturally imply to you?
I mean, if I hear a politician is proposing a reform, I instantly think they're fixing something that's broken. It implies a positive improvement.
Exactly. But what if the actual policy being proposed is a massive budget cut that will eliminate public services for thousands of people?
Oh, I see.
Right. By labeling it entitlement reform or tax reform rather than service reduction, the media has already embedded a moral judgment into the issue.
The debate is literally over before it begins because you are already operating inside a positive framing.
You're starting on their terms.
Oh, wow. You see that everywhere, actually. You hear a phrase like restoring market confidence, and you don't even question it. You just think, well, obviously we have to protect that. That's a good thing.
Or consider the label extremism.
Right.
Who gets to define what is extreme and what is moderate?
Good point.
When journalistic routines adopt these words as just neutral, objective descriptions, they are doing the heavy lifting of hegemony. They are providing the default vocabulary through which citizens judge what is respectable, what is dangerous, and what is just completely absurd.
So for you listening right now, the next time you scroll through your morning news feed, look really closely at the adjectives. The headlines aren't just giving you raw data. They are quietly framing the boundaries of what you are supposed to consider a realistic policy.
Very quietly.
But look, I have to challenge this a bit.
Go for it.
I understand that language shapes reality, and I get that journalists share professional norms. But when five different competing networks run the exact same headline with the exact same framing at 6:00 p.m., it's hard not to feel like someone somewhere sent out a memo.
It does feel coordinated.
Yeah. If there is no smoke-filled room of billionaires dictating the headlines, how is this structural convergence actually physically happening? How do thousands of journalists who are desperately trying to scoop each other end up sounding totally identical?
Well, that structural convergence is really the central mystery the report tackles. And it answers your challenge by breaking down a process model of media hegemony.
A process model.
Right. It outlines how you get perfectly coordinated looking outcomes without any actual coordinator. It is just a consequence of institutional mechanics. Think about a local newsroom. Walk through a day in the life of a stressed editorial desk.
Yep.
They are facing brutal daily deadlines. They have super limited staff. So how do they fill the broadcast? They monitor the exact same wire services as their competitors. And crucially, they rely heavily on official press releases.
Like from the police department or the mayor's office.
Yes. Or corporate PR departments.
Because it's cheap, it's fast, and, well, it's legally safe.
Precisely. It is highly quotable and it protects them from libel. Add to that an intense organizational fear of making a catastrophic error and standing out in a bad way.
Nobody wants to be the one network that got it wrong.
Exactly. Yeah. So when a complex issue arises, reporters instinctively index their coverage to what powerful official actors are saying. If you have hundreds of stressed editors across the country making these exact same locally rational decisions, prioritizing official sources for safety and speed, it creates an aggregate nationwide conformity.
No memo required.
No memo required.
It's just layers of power stacking on top of each other. The report breaks this down into four specific layers, actually. And the one that really caught my eye was symbolic power.
Oh, yeah.
The report brings up Walter Lippmann, this journalist from the 1920s, and his concept of pseudo-environments. Now, the term sounds super academic, but the mechanics of it are wild.
Lippmann's theory is absolutely vital to understanding media power. I mean, yeah. He pointed out a basic human limitation. The citizens just have to act on a world they cannot directly observe.
Right.
You and I cannot see the entire global economy. We cannot directly observe a distant foreign war. We can't even see the crime rate in our own massive city, right? We only see our own street.
Just what's right in front of us.
Because we cannot experience the macro world directly, we rely on mediated pictures of the world. These are what Lippmann called pseudo-environments, and they're constructed entirely by the press.
So, okay, To use the economy as an example, I go to the grocery store and I see that a gallon of milk is way more expensive. That is my direct environment.
Right.
But I have no idea if that's a global supply chain issue, a corporate price gouging strategy, or like inflation caused by the Federal Reserve. The media takes my localized experience and places it into a massive pseudo-environment called the looming recession or the post-pandemic recovery.
Yes, exactly. And symbolic power is the ability to construct and frame that overarching pseudo-environment. It is the power to draw the boundary between a quote-unquote mainstream economic claim and a deviant economic claim. And that leads directly into how the report categorizes the different forms of media hegemony. It lists 7 distinct types, but 2 of them really highlight how this boundary drawing works in practice.
Right. There is state-centered, capital-centered, cultural, but let's look at the 2 that really jump out when you watch, you know, the Sunday morning political shows. Knowledge hegemony and elite network hegemony. Break down the mechanics of those for me.
Sure. So knowledge hegemony operates on credentialism. It is the societal agreement that certain experts, usually from Ivy League universities or well-funded think tanks, are the default interpreters of complex problems.
Right.
When a war breaks out, the news network doesn't interview a local peace activist. They interview a retired general or a defense contractor consultant.
Mm-hmm.
The hegemony is the assumption that the general is an objective expert, while the activist is a biased partisan.
And then the elite network hegemony is just the social reality of places like Washington or London or Paris. The politicians, the corporate executives, and the top-tier journalists all go to the same galas. Their kids go to the same private schools. They live in the same exact neighborhoods.
Yeah.
They aren't conspiring. They just literally share the same class interests and social circles, which naturally limits the types of questions they even think to ask each other.
Exactly. Now, to truly see this invisible architecture operating in the real world, the report zooms in on a specific case study.
Oh, this part is fascinating.
It looks at a media ecosystem with intense, cutthroat commercial competition, but deep underlying shared assumptions. The United States.
Okay, now I want to frame how we are approaching this really carefully for our listeners.
Yes, please do.
The report looks at the United States, specifically examining both the quote-unquote liberal media hegemony and the conservative media ecosystem. And we aren't exploring this to judge who is right or wrong or to take any political side at all.
Not at all.
The report is actually zooming out to look at the structural blueprints of both. We are just impartially exploring the source's objective analysis here. It maps how both sides, despite hating each other, use the exact same architectural rules to maintain authority over their audiences.
It is a fascinating structural analysis, really, because the U.S. combines incredibly strong constitutional press freedom with a highly polarized, relentlessly commercialized media market.
Right.
You have legacy institutions, massive cable news networks, and digital publishers all just competing fiercely for eyeballs. It looks, on the surface, like total chaos and disagreement.
You know, the analogy that kept flashing in my mind while reading this section was professional wrestling.
Oh, I love that.
Right. Think about the left-leaning media ecosystem and the right-leaning media ecosystem as 2 massive heavyweight pro wrestlers. They fight fiercely. They put on a spectacular show of conflict, slamming each other, cutting promos, and playing it directly to their respective crowds.
It feels like total war.
Exactly. It feels real. But look at the mechanics. They both agree to stay inside the exact same ring. They both recognize the referee. They follow the unwritten rules of the match. And most importantly, they rely on the exact same institutional premises and official sources to generate the fight in the first place.
The wrestling ring is a superb representation of shared hegemonic boundaries. The authors of the report propose a brilliant diagnostic test for spotting this. If you want to find the real hegemony in a polarized system, don't look at what the networks are fighting about.
Okay.
Look at what they agree on. Which institutions do they both treat as inherently legitimate, even if they completely disagree on the current leadership?
Oh.
Notice how corporate executives and government officials appear as the default, credible voices on both sides of the aisle. Notice which policy options are quietly ignored by both networks as just unrealistic. The intense partisan conflict is absolutely real, don't get me wrong, but it happens entirely inside a deeper structural consensus.
And as the report details, that wrestling match has basically become the only show in town, which reveals a terrifying vulnerability in the U.S. system. I want to look at the data they included from the 2025 Medill local news report because, frankly, it stopped me in my tracks.
You're talking about the collapse of the local news infrastructure.
Yes. Let me introduce these numbers slowly because they are heavy. as of 2025, there are 213 counties in the United States that have absolutely no local news source.
Wow.
Zero, no newspaper, no digital outlet, no local radio covering the town hall.
Complete information blackouts at the civic level.
And it gets worse. Another 1,524 counties have only one surviving local news source, usually some ghost-staffed weekly paper.
Right.
When you add that all up, it leaves roughly 50 million Americans living in local news deserts. So, mechanically, how does the death of the small-town paper impact this massive concept of media hegemony?
Well, it is entirely about the vacuum it creates. When local, place-based reporting institutions die, citizens lose the specific information that empowers their immediate communities.
Yeah.
I mean, if you don't know why your property taxes went up or who is running for the school board or why the local factory is polluting the river, you lose your agency. But human beings still crave information, so nature abhors a vacuum. When the local watchdog disappears, citizens are forced to rely entirely on nationalized hegemonic narratives.
The national wrestling mat.
Exactly. The local reality is replaced by the national spectacle. You might not know your own mayor's name, but you know exactly what two national pundits are screaming about on cable news.
It's wild.
This fundamentally shifts political power away from local communities and hands it directly to national elites and, increasingly, digital intermediaries.
Which brings us to the massive elephant in the room. The digital intermediaries. The platforms.
There we go.
We have spent this deep dive exploring how legacy newspapers and television shape reality human editors making decisions based on deadlines, norms, and economics. But the report explicitly highlights that the center of gravity has already shifted. Human editors are no longer the apex predators of information.
They really aren't.
So, what is the reality here? Did the internet break the old media hegemony by letting anyone publish a blog or a video? Or did we just trade human gatekeepers for AI gatekeepers that are completely opaque to us?
The report argues that it is a bit of both, but we are rapidly accelerating toward a new, potentially much more concentrated form of power. It details the epochal shift from legacy gatekeeping to platform gatekeeping.
Okay, tell me more about that.
Think about the difference in mechanics. Legacy gatekeeping, the old newspaper editor, decided what got produced. They decided what stories to assign in print. Platform gatekeeping, the algorithm, decides what actually gets seen, in what order, and who gets paid for it.
And the data they pull from the Reuters Institute 2026 report proves that the shift has already happened. Let's look at this. Averaged across 48 global markets, 54% of people now use social media and video networks as their primary source for news.
Over half.
That officially surpasses the number of people going directly to a publisher's website or app.
Right. The audience no longer walks to the front door of the newspaper. They just wait for the platform to hand them an article.
Right. And even more startling, 10% of people are already using AI chatbots as a weekly news source. And when you isolate the 18 to 24-year-old demographic, 52% say social media, video networks, and AI chatbots are their main way of getting news.
The structural conclusion from that data is just undeniable.
Mm.
Publishers no longer control the final interface through which audiences encounter their journalism.
Yeah.
That interface, the search engine, the social feed, the AI summary, is the new primary locus of hegemonic power. And the report meticulously details the specific mechanical powers these tech platforms now hold. First, there's ranking power.
Which is just deciding which of a million possible items appears at the top of your feed. Because if you are on page two of search results, you basically don't exist.
Precisely. Then there's eligibility power. This is the platform's ability to decide if a piece of content is even allowed to be recommended by the algorithm or if it can be monetized.
And we all know the reality of that. If an independent creator gets demonetized by the platform, they essentially cease to exist in a commercial media ecosystem. They simply can't afford to produce the work.
It is an incredible choke point. Then you have personalization power, where the platform constructs a completely different empirical reality for different users based on their data profile.
Wow.
But the most disruptive new force is AI synthesis power. This is where a user asks a chatbot for the news, and the AI just scrapes, digests, and summarizes multiple sources into a single authoritative paragraph.
Removing the original publisher completely. A 20-year-old asking their AI for the daily news never clicks a link. They never see the original journalist's framing. They just get the machine synthesized truth.
Yes.
So if the old hegemony was a shared national default setting, what happens to a society's common sense when the gatekeepers isn't a human with professional democratic norms, but a black box machine optimizing purely for engagement?
Well, the report argues that it fragments society entirely. It shatters the old single-center hegemony into multiple isolated algorithmic attention regimes. Right. Instead of everyone swimming in the same massive ocean, even if they disagreed about the temperature of the water, we are now all trapped in our own little algorithmic fishbowls. Each fishbowl has its own set of authoritative sources, its own echo chambers, its own hyperspecific taboos, and its own version of common sense.
And unlike the front page of a classic newspaper, which everyone in town could look at, point to, and, you know, critique, these algorithmic decisions are totally invisible. You can't hold a town hall to debate why an AI ranked a story the way it did for one specific user, because the AI is constantly mutating based on invisible behavioral feedback loops.
It is a fundamentally different paradigm of power. The old hegemony wanted to manufacture your consent to a shared reality. The new platform hegemony just wants to manufacture your constant attention, regardless of what reality it has to build around you to keep you scrolling.
Okay, we have covered an immense amount of ground today. We started with the Greek roots of hegemony and Gramsci's idea of common sense, how media sets the default settings of society.
Right.
We unpacked the fascinating mechanics of why competing newsrooms end up sounding identical, exploring how wire services, fear of errors, and Lippmann's pseudo-environments forge a structural consensus.
Mm-hmm.
We mapped the U.S. partisan wrestling match, proving how fierce combat can exist inside shared institutional boundaries, especially as local news deserts expand. And finally, we explored the chilling shift to AI and platform gatekeepers, where algorithms wielding ranking and synthesis power are rewriting the very rules of visibility.
It is a profound evolution in how human beings interact with information and, honestly, each other.
It really is. Yeah. And for you listening right now, the mission of this deep dive was to hand you a new lens. Being truly well-informed isn't just about reading the news and memorizing the facts. It is about observing how the news is structured. It's taking a step back from the headline and asking why certain experts are chosen, why certain moral frameworks are embedded in the language, and what realities are being quietly omitted from the agenda.
Which leaves us with a critical, lingering thought to carry forward into your week. The next time you open your phone and scroll through a completely personalized AI-curated newsfeed, take a pause and ask yourself if your version of common sense is now being shaped moment by moment by an opaque algorithm designed purely for engagement and retention, who is really manufacturing your consent today?
You might just find yourself looking up, searching the sky, wondering who or what is holding the strings.